Welcome to episode 471 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. My name is Michael Eriksson, and let me start today with a bit of a personal update. I know the typical style of this podcast isn't to go into personal updates. It's all about the content, what you can get out of it, whether it's from the interviewee or from my solo episodes. But this time I think it's worth it because it's big news. We've had a little baby. By the time you hear this, he might be getting close to 1 month old. He was born towards the end of August. And yeah, everything is going well. Mom and baby are very healthy and we're all super happy. So just wanted to share that because, yeah, it's just obviously very exciting news for us and we're very happy for it. In terms of what it means for the podcast, I think from now on, not so much. I'm starting to get back into more of a normal routine. And so even though September has been a bit light and I've just put out one episode that was already recorded, and this episode where I already had done the interview and just recording this intro and outro separately. Other than that, yeah, it's been a bit more quiet, I guess, but from now on, I think I'll get back into more of a routine and putting up content with a similar frequency to before, I would say. So I think that you don't have to expect anything in terms of changes there from now on. But let's get into introducing today's guest. It's Monique Ryan. She's a registered dietitian specializing in endurance sports. Monique was a guest on the podcast back in the early days, in early 2018 already. So it was really great to have her back 7 years later, because while the basics on nutrition hydration haven't changed, there have definitely been tweaks and trends, smaller changes in what you might call a best practice or common practice. So we'll hear a bit about what Monique's take on this is, just through how she answers the questions, which are kind of the typical most commonly asked questions that you get from within endurance sports, from athletes, from coaches, and so on. So it's a mix of topics that we cover, but yeah, I think you'll find hopefully lots of good information there. But quickly before that, let's thank our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They are the title sponsors of this year's Ironman 7.3 World Championships in Marbella. Their pH-1000 electrolytes will be at the aid stations on course to ensure athletes remain well hydrated. And as well as electrolytes, they have a range of fueling products to help you fuel your training and racing. One product that I think is really brilliant for longer distances, especially on the bike, but also on the run, is the Flow Gel. With that, you get 300 grams of carbs that you can put in a 500 milliliter bottle. So it's basically a drinkable gel that flows super easily. On the bike leg, because of the fact that you get so many carbs in a relatively small bottle, it's absolutely brilliant. But also for the run, maybe not for a half marathon, but for the full marathon of an Ironman, it's really useful because you can use a soft flask with the Flow Gel, and you can have basically access to all of the carbs that you will need for the entire marathon instead of carrying 10 gels or having to grab a lot of stuff from every single aid station that you might not even like or be familiar with. So that's a really good option, and especially for the Ironman, you can use it both on the bike and for the run. For a half distance race, I typically use it only on the bike and used a bit, yeah, fewer, more normally sized gels on the run. You can try any Precision Fuel and Hydration products with a 15% discount using the code TTS2025 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Monique Ryan. Welcome back to That Triathlon Show, Monique. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you today?
I'm excellent. Friday afternoon, so almost done with most of the work for the week.
Yeah, just Friday.
So I'm going to go out for a ride after this, which I'm looking forward to, but I'm excited for this interview before that. Can we start with an introduction to yourself? Because it's been a few hundred episodes since you've been on the show last time.
Yeah, glad to be on. Thank you. So I'm a registered dietitian and nutritionist and sports dietitian nutritionist here in the Chicago area. And I've been in private practice since 1992. In the 1990s, I worked with the Saturn cycling team, the Volvo Cannondale mountain bike team, various triathletes. I worked with the Timex multi-sport team and just worked with a lot of individual age group athletes in my private practice. I've done some consulting work with Ironman. I was a subject matter expert for the nutrition module for their Ironman coaching certification, Ironman University, and have done myself 9 70.3 Ironmans, and also had a cycling background. just at the age group level, just having fun. And recently, the fourth edition of my book, Sports Nutrition for Endurance Athletes, came out in February of this year. And it's a great reference. It's about 500 pages. So it covers all the different, all the latest science on training nutrition, good healthy nutrition, but also has a specific chapter for triathlon, but also for running, for cycling, and swimming.
Yeah, excellent. That's a great background. And just to start off on a bit of a lighthearted way, of the events that you've done in triathlon, which one would you consider your favorite event?
Well, I did the one and only Ironman 70.3 in Traverse City. And that's in north part of Michigan, not the northern peninsula, but the north part of the southern peninsula of Michigan. And they had to move it to Frankfort, Michigan the year after that. And I liked that course a lot too. But I loved the Traverse City course. It was really a beautiful bike ride, which is my favorite part of the race.
Nice. And today, what does your work consist of today? You've recently obviously updated your book, so that's probably been a big project. But now that it's done, is it mostly consulting work with athletes of different kinds, or what are you keeping? What's keeping you busy today?
Consulting work with athletes of different kinds, all ages, all sports, but also I do just preventative, integrative, and functional nutrition for anybody that has different health concerns. And many times I combine the two. So I might have somebody who's training for an Ironman or a marathon, and they might be a middle-aged age grouper, and I need to do some of my other nutrition strategies with them besides getting them ready for their event, just because they have some symptoms or health concerns. So I can actually integrate the two together and do both, which I think they appreciate.
Is there something in your day-to-day work that people that maybe haven't worked with a registered dietitian before would find surprising? Like, oh, I didn't realize that this is something that is part of your role and your responsibilities.
You know, I'm not really sure. Maybe they don't understand that I do a lot of testing, that I can do a lot of testing, like I can do food sensitivity testing to see what foods are causing inflammation in their diet. I can do micronutrient testing. And they might be tests that aren't standard clinical tests, or I might recommend some standard clinical tests. And probably they don't understand that people don't always appreciate that I'm going to take their health history and look at their whole health background. And a lot of people that are very active in doing these events might still have things that they need help with in terms of their general health and preventative health. So maybe they don't know that a registered dietitian does that. Maybe they don't know that we have a lot of, we go deep into their health background as well. And it's yeah. You know, maybe a lot of people are familiar with influencers on social media that give little health tips or training tips or nutrition tips, that we go much more in depth than that, I guess is what I would say. That might surprise them.
Yeah. Well, that is not surprising to me. However, I would say that I wouldn't have known that you do direct testing. I would have thought that that's something that is usually referred out to some kind of hospital or something like that if somebody needs food sensitivity testing or so that's...
Oh, no. I can do a lot of direct testing. There's a lot of independent labs that allow licensed healthcare professionals to order certain tests. As long as I'm qualified to interpret the test and give a protocol for that test, then it's within my scope of practice to do so.
All right. Well, let's get into some nutrition topics. We have quite a few of them on the sheet today. So if we start with, I guess what I want to start with is just the common issues or areas for improvement that you come across when you work with endurance athletes. And if you could categorize these as one to two or one to three most common issues within one, the athlete's daily nutrition or hydration, and then their training nutrition hydration, and then finally their racing nutrition hydration, that can include pre-race. What are some common mistakes or areas for improvement you see in these three categories?
Well, I would say, do you want to focus on triathlon in this question more than anything?
I mean, triathlon is the main sport here, but we do have listeners from other endurance sports. So I wouldn't want you to be completely locked into triathlon if there's something important in other sports that you would want to bring up.
Well, I think sometimes what you have is athletes that have a little bit of experience that come to you that have focused on the training and doing the training and just talking to other athletes or their coach about nutrition but they've not worked with a nutritionist and gone into as much detail. So they don't get as much of a personalized plan. And then you just have a lot of people who are doing their first event that are new to it and are maybe talented athletes, but they could even do better with a real focus on nutrition. So I would say it's focusing on a lot of things like the training and maybe joining a tri club, maybe joining a cycling club and getting advice from different people, but not really getting expert advice from a qualified nutritionist or dietitian. It might be something that I've seen. And that when they eventually do it, I think they realize that they get something very much more personalized and precise that helps them just in their recovery, but also for the race day as well, the event day.
But what are the actual things, like specific examples of things that change?
I think sometimes not understanding like their full nutritional needs on big training days and not consuming enough, thinking that getting lean is like a priority, but they need to consume more calories, more carbohydrates, and not knowing how to change it for different training days and how they might, the nutrition plan needs to be adjusted for different training days. So under eating and under recovering might be something that you see. But on the other hand, too, like you can have somebody training for a marathon and they might have two long training days and some very easy recovery days, and they don't know how to adjust for the recovery days or the easier training days to not overeat because they're hungry, and they need to kind of find the balance as well. So that might be something that I see. And then just in terms of what they have during, a lot of them just get started and say, oh, I'll do a gel an hour, or I'll do a bottle in an hour of two scoops of a carbohydrate electrolyte mix or a sports drink. And they don't understand what their nutritional needs are for that length of training, that duration of training or intensity of training, or they find the gels hard and they don't take enough water with the gels. So it's just, they just get started, but they don't have any real guidance. And they just sort of start with what they've heard about, but don't really know like the full extent of what they require and how to get to that. And that they might have to suffer a little bit to get used to those volumes and those amounts of gels or that concentration of a sports drink, have their stomach adapt to it and get used to it so that they can handle it, because that's really what they will need during the race or the event.
So would you say, is it fair to say then that this mistake that we're talking about here in training is just flying a bit by the seat of your pants? You know, you take some gels, but you don't really know why you're doing it or how much you should take and how much water you should take with it.
I see that a lot. And I see that even with really good athletes that have good race experiences, that because they're just talented and they're so well trained, they don't optimize their nutrition program. And then I just see beginners that are new during their first marathon just think that, you know, one or two gels in the whole race is going to cover them.
Yeah, I think that was my first marathon.
Can't remember,
but I don't think it was much more than that. In the day-to-day, what you said there, I just want to specify it a little bit more. If I understand you correctly, I guess the main things that you're talking about there would be that maybe not understanding your nutritional needs and for your training demands, and B, not really understanding how that changes on a day-to-day basis based on your training load. Are those the two most important ones that you talked about there?
And then you'll especially see that for a 70.3 or 140.6, but especially a 140.6 when they're, you know, I know you don't want to just stick to triathlon, but I see it more in triathlon than marathon, because there's so many big, big training cycles, and that they just don't know how to take it to that next level. But I think once they get that information, that's great. But I think what a lot of them need help with is the structure of how to do it, you know, because a lot of these people are working full time and then they're training anywhere from 12 to 20 hours per week, maybe up to 30 some weeks. So just how to organize everything so that they can have simple meals ready, they can have the food ready that they need to have, and that they can really implement the plan, and they're not just leaving it to, oh, what am I going to have for dinner tonight? That they're meal planning and looking ahead to what they need and having things kind of in place that make it easy for them to train in the morning, eat, recover, go to work, train in the afternoon or evening, recover, and go to sleep, and, you know, just have everything available. What do they need to pack for the day? What do they need to have pre-made? So I think a lot of what I do is explain the needs to them. That's the easy part, but also show them how to do it. You know, because I think just in general, people don't always meal plan very much. But then when you have this whole extra training burden that you're enjoying and want to do, it's just a lot of time, and you need to really be focused and plan ahead so that you have what you need available to you.
What are a couple of practical tips that you give athletes when it comes to how to meal plan, how to manage that, how to be efficient and not waste time?
Yeah, I give them a meal plan and sample menus and food lists so that they can make other menus. But I also have a Pinterest board with recipes that might work for athletes. And then I just encourage them to batch cook a lot, you know, and to show them simple meals that they can make. So you wouldn't even call it cooking, but also they can cook like a batch of something that they can have three times and they don't have to cook every night. So that's a lot of what I help them with. And that really depends on the person, how they want to implement that.
Can you give a couple of examples of meals, like not the entire recipe, but just the types of meals that you think are good and that a lot of athletes seem to like and that they're quick to make and you can batch cook them?
A lot of athletes like to make bowls. You know, we're big on bowls here in the United States. I don't know how it works over in Europe.
Yeah, they're coming, I think.
We're big on bowls. And obviously wraps and burritos and sandwiches are all fine. And, you know, just simple ways to get like raw vegetables in that you can buy. But for dinner, you know, like slow cooker recipes or stir fry recipes, things that you can make in batches, you know, make 4 or 5 servings of. And maybe somebody's preparing meals for the whole family and they have to really do it every night. But recipes that emphasize lean proteins, starches like quinoa, brown rice, pastas, potatoes, starchy vegetables, and then just good green vegetables, non-starchy vegetables for their good nutrient content, you know, healthy fats with olive oil, avocado oil, nuts and seeds. So a lot of just keeping it simple, really a lot of time is what helps people. Making a batch of brown rice or a batch of quinoa that lasts 3 days, grilling chicken breasts ahead of time, steaming vegetables, you know, a couple servings, or, you know, doing that quickly every night if you want to have something fresh, along with the other foods that you pre-prepared.
Yeah. So. And coming back to that mistake about not having a plan for your intake during training that you mentioned, and I interpreted that as also during racing. So would you say that is the most common mistake also in racing
yes.
And in training? Okay.
Yes, or waiting too long to develop a plan.
Yeah.
No, because it takes time, and you have to do it for triathlon and for marathon. You have to do it during your long workouts. You can try your plan during the shorter workouts, but you really want to implement it and see how it goes during the big training days, you know, where you have the 4 or 5 hour bike and the 1 hour run, you know, the brick workout. How does my stomach feel when I start doing this transition run? And did it work out? Did I feel good during the bike? Did I maintain my pace on the bike, that I was supposed to do? And just having enough days of practicing it so that when you get to the race, you did it exactly how you practiced it and you knew it was going to work. And if something happens during the race where you have to adjust because of just whatever, you know how to adjust your plan. You feel comfortable doing that because it's your plan.
What is, if you give some very generic advice that nobody should take as personalized advice here about fluid intake and carbohydrate intake for an Ironman, a generic Ironman in generic temperature, so nothing too special on one way or the other. What would you try to get an athlete to take in for their fluid intake and their carbohydrate intake per hour?
Fluid intake can be tricky because, you know, I'm working with somebody now who's doing his first Ironman and he hasn't done his first 70.3 for training yet, but in training, he was taking in a lot of fluid per hour. He did remarkably well. And his sweat rate was maybe half of that. And he said, oh, I had a headache. And I said, you overhydrated. So he did. And it was July here in Illinois and it was hot. It was probably like 90s. So he was thirsty and he was able to drink that much. So it's really hard to give generic fluid advice. So the generic advice would be, in an Ironman, you on the bike, you want to have 75 to 90 grams of carbohydrate per hour, and you want to match your sweat rate or minimize your sweat losses. So for some people, that might be 30 ounces per hour. I should probably do this in liters. I'm sorry. It should be, it could be 1.2 liters per hour, or it could be 2.5 liters per hour. So it's going to be different concentrations of a drink and how many bottles per hour, how many bottles are on your bike. Generally, I would say if you're at 700 to 1,000 milligrams of sodium per hour, you're going to be okay, unless you're just an unusually high salt loss person, which I've encountered a couple of those people. So those people kind of know who they are. They've figured it out. So they had some problems in previous races or in training, and they know they need to adapt. But I think you can do that mostly with a sports drink or adding salt to your drink. I haven't really recently recommended salt tablets. I think people want to put things in the mix and just have that in the mix. So most people won't need to exceed 1,000 milligrams of sodium per hour. 75 milligrams of carbohydrate per hour on the bike is good, but 90 might be even better. And then on the run, you know, we want you to have those amounts, but that's harder to do. So if people do well on the bike, and then on the run, they can do at least 60 grams of carbohydrate per hour, but 75 would be better. I've not really seen anybody hit 90 too easily. And then knowing what the sodium content of the electrolyte drink on the course would be. So here in Ironman North America sections, we have a good high sodium electrolyte drink. It's not a sports drink. So people are combining gels with that. Gels might be on the course. They might carry some of their gels, and just knowing they can use a variety of gels, but it might really be taking 3 gels per hour to really hit your target, so that they have to learn how to do that. So that's my generic advice for that.
Yeah.
So the people that are the low sweat rate people need to know who they are, because they need to figure out how concentrated their drink's going to be if they're going to do this and not overhydrate. And we know that those people are probably in the minority, which is fine. But it's important for them to know who they are. And you don't know who you are. You don't know if that's you until you test, right? And then just people with abnormally high sweat losses and sodium losses need to know who they are too, because that's also a safety issue.
Yeah, sweat rate testing is easy to do, right? Just weigh yourself before and after, subtract the fluid you took in during training. Ideally, try to do that in conditions that simulate race day, or in different conditions, different intensities, so that you build up a knowledge base basically for you, how it varies based on conditions and intensity.
Yeah, and you meant add in the fluid that you took in to your sweat rate.
Yes. Subtract was not in a mathematical sense, just in in verbal sense. What about, how do you go about assessing whether somebody has a high sodium content in their sweat?
Well, we have some patches. So here we have the Gatorade RX sweat patch. And I know they tested it for many years. So that's easily accessible. They can buy that. And then there's another biosensor here called the NYX biosensor that also uses a patch. And you can use that in different conditions. And then there's some testing that can be done, but those are sort of one and done. They're not testing in different conditions over different situations for different modalities. So I prefer the tests that you can do repeatedly, where you can get sodium content in different conditions so that you just have an understanding of your sodium losses. And I always emphasize to people, you don't have to 100% replace your sodium losses to maintain safe sodium levels. You know, it's different than the sweat losses with fluid, where you're trying to minimize the losses. You know, be at 80% to 99%, let's say, if you can't be 100%, but you don't want to be at like 50 to 70% of your sweat losses. Whereas with sodium, it's really just replacing enough of your sodium losses to stay at a safe level of blood sodium levels.
So what would you say that, what is that breaking point where somebody is such a high, or their sodium content is high enough that they would need to consider maybe taking more than that 1,000 milligrams per hour that you said as generic advice?
I had I had one person that had tested, and it was a good test, but it's kind of like a one at time test. And it was very, very high. And I think I would have to pull his chart, which I don't have here, to look at what the sodium losses were. But I think it was like 3,000 milligrams per hour. And it turned out he'd had some genetic testing because he and his wife recently had a child, and he had the gene for cystic fibrosis. So I just said, do you have the gene for cystic fibrosis? He said, yeah, because they just went through genetic testing. And that was what was causing those abnormally high sodium losses for him. Mm-hmm. So that's unusual. I haven't really seen that too much, but usually the people that kind of decide that they have high sodium losses in the past have been people that have really suffered from muscle cramping and had some really bad experience in the race. But I think that it's worth looking at the whole big picture for them. You know, were you overhydrating? Were you underhydrating? Were you underfueling? Have you had muscle cramping in training? You know, and you can certainly have a high sodium intake leading up to the race if it's more of a muscle cramping issue. You know, And muscle cramps are still kind of a mystery, you know, many times. Yep. And obviously most of them have experienced that when they've sort of seen that in very hot conditions, racing conditions, which can happen very often, right?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that probably covers it for, well, we came into that topic from the mistakes, but we also covered some good general advice for carbohydrates. Oh, sorry. One follow-up that I wanted to ask you is a lot of athletes these days are going well beyond 90 grams per hour, especially on the bike. Even age groupers, I think there's quite a few, let's say, faster age groupers that are pushing at least 120 grams per hour.
Right.
And what is your take on that?
I think you have to be careful because you can end up with a stomach fill that's not emptying very quickly. And we don't know exactly how much of that is being absorbed. There's probably a lot of grams. There's probably some carbohydrate in the interstitial fluid in the small intestine. But what I've seen is that it's more likely to happen in road racing and cycling where you have repeated stages, and that at the end of that 5-hour bike or whatever that might be, you're not running a marathon or half marathon where your stomach has to kind of adapt to whatever is in your stomach and what's still emptying from in your intestines and stomach. So I think you have to be really careful with that. Somebody did call me recently saying that he did 120 grams per hour, a young kid doing his first Ironman. He had a really tough time on the run with his stomach. So I think it was too much for him. So I think you have to be careful. Even if you've done it in training and then you've run for an hour, it can really vary depending on the conditions of the race. And again, he had to run a whole marathon after that. So I think there's still a lot to find out about that. But I think if there's any real application right now, it would be in stage racing on the bike.
All right. Let's move on to carb loading, which is something that I want to discuss. And I feel like it's almost, when I first got into endurance sports, it was talked about a lot. And then I feel like it has become almost taken for granted to the degree that I think people are getting a bit lazy with it and almost forgetting about it and ignoring it. What is your take on carb loading, first of all? And what would you say are the best practices for how to go about carb loading?
My take on carb loading is you have to see what works best for your event. And everybody, most triathlons, you're going to have a taper, especially for a 70.3 or 140.6. So it's really nice to taper and rest. And the whole idea of that is to not just rest your muscles and recover completely before the race, but also to replenish all your body fuel stores, right? And carbohydrate being the most important one. And it's, of course, to your advantage to start any event or race with full muscle glycogen stores and liver glycogen stores. So if you carbo load properly, you know, you're going to still have some training in the days leading up to the race. You might have one full day off, or you might just have a day where you do 15 minutes of each discipline at kind of like, you know, a little bit like a jumpy, keeping the intensity high just because activating that part of your system. And it's really a good chance to not have to worry so much about protein intake. You're not going to be breaking down muscle, but you might want to have some protein intake, of course, because you enjoy it and it's part of a meal. You don't have to eat too. You don't have to replenish fat stores because you're not doing these big, huge workouts. So really, carbohydrates are going to maximize your muscle glycogen stores and really replenish your muscles. So you can call it carb loading then, I guess, right? You're carb loading, you're tapering, you're resting, you're carb loading. You don't want to overdo your calories because you're not doing a whole lot. So a higher proportion of your foods are going to come from carbohydrates. That's kind of what you're going to emphasize. And you want to have things that are just easy on your stomach, that are simple, especially like the day before the race. So for an Ironman, I'll have people carbo load. Let's say it's a Sunday race. I'll have them carbo load on Thursday and Friday and really kind of go for it on Thursday and Friday, where you might get a little full and it's kind of a strange diet. And then on Saturday, just really eat well. And again, you're carbo loading, but you don't have to be as intense about it because you've got time to do it. And then you can wake up race morning and not feel stuffed and like you've overeaten and feel ready to go. I think the same thing's nice to do for a marathon, where you might have, often here it's a Sunday race, and you might carbo load on Friday, and then Saturday you can just really rest, put your feet up, and just eat well and eat things that are going to empty well from your stomach, that's easy on your stomach. And again, so you wake up race morning and you're hungry and you're ready to eat your pre-race meal. But here we have a lot of people that go to expos and, you know, they have to register. They might walk around an expo. And it, for the Chicago Marathon, you can walk like 3 miles at the expo from parking to the expo and go, you know, go to all the different places, check in. So you have to bring things with you to eat and hydrate so that you're not leaving it to chance. And, oh, I have to eat. It's the night before the race. I better go have some pasta. You know, you don't want to do that. And a lot of people think carbo loading is like a pasta dinner before the race, the night before the race. And it's really much more than that. That's not a bad thing to do, but it's probably not the only thing they should do. And then you also have cycling, stage racing. You know, cyclists don't really taper a whole lot. They do a whole lot. They always eat a lot of carbs, and they might need to just have a lot of simple carbs the day before a big day, a big race, but it just depends on the caliber, you know, the race, if it's a pro, if it's just age group, and they can also think about it as well.
And if we put some numbers to it, what is that something that you do with the athletes you work with?
Yeah, I put a number to it, but then I just do a plan for them. And then I'll see, you know, where you're going to be. Are you going to be at home? Are you traveling? Have you looked at what food is available? You know, what the restaurants are available, that where you can grab food? Are you going to buy food? Are you going to bring food with you? You know, what is the plan? And then base it on their food preferences. But so if they're going to carbo load like 2 or 3 days, I might go a little more gently because it's just easier to do and do like 8 grams per kilogram, 6 to 8 grams per kilogram. But if you have one day to carbo load, you really have to go for it. 10 grams per kilogram to 12 grams per kilogram is like the big day. But that's hard to do like the day before, because you can get, it's a lot of food and you can get really full. So you might even want to do that 2 days before if you have less time. You know, I remember in the 90s driving up to a mountain bike race, like an 8-hour drive, and just drinking some soda and eating simple food and packing pretzels and, you know, carbo loading like a couple days before the race. Might have even been the day before the race, but I had to, it was easy to do and it kind of accomplished it. It was a 40-mile mountain bike race, and I felt rested and fueled.
For when you prescribe 8 grams or 6 to 8 grams per kilo body weight to athletes, do they tend to perceive that as a lot or kind of very manageable? Because at least if you go for 10 to 12, then that's for sure something that almost all athletes would not be very used to. It's a surprisingly big amount of carbohydrates and surprisingly hard to manage.
Right. Like a cyclist might be used to that, like in a big training day, but a lot of that was consumed during exercise, right? If they had 10 grams per kilogram. And really the triathletes may have had the 6 to 8 grams per kilogram. It's just they did it on training days where they're hungry and they're also consuming sports drinks. And so it's very different. They're not as hungry because they're not doing the big workouts. And it can be hard to do. So you know, you come up with the 4-ounce bagel for the bagel that has 60 grams of carbohydrate and a glass of juice, you know, real juice, real fruit juice. You know, more rice is more concentrated than pasta. So sometimes rice is a really good carbo-loading food, and maybe it will be white rice because it'll be easier to just eat a big bowl of white rice as well. So you just look at foods that they feel would be easy to carbo-load with too. And of course, I'll ask them that, and that's what we're trying to do. We're developing a carbo-loading plan that will work for them. But yes, it's a big difference. But many people are happy to eat that food.
What's your take on if the volume of food is still a lot for you, especially if you're doing that one day carb load with 10 to 12 grams, is it okay to supplement with things like Haribo's, jams, and things like that too?
Yeah, I think jam and honey are good things, good ways to get a lot of concentrated carbohydrates. And they can be, you know, the real jams, like not like high fructose corn syrup. They can be sugar. I think it's definitely fine to do that. And I think most plans I'm going to do some jam or honey and juice, because you just need to, you can't feel like a heavy, you can't do it with a salad. You know, you're not going to eat a salad. Yeah.
Any other pre-race nutrition tips other than the carb load? And did we cover everything for the carb load?
Well, you can salt your food, you know, obviously hydrate well, and then really know exactly what you want to have race morning. And you should have practiced that in training. And you might have to get up a little, what I've noticed a lot of times in training, people don't want to get up more than 2 hours before a big training day. And that's totally understandable. But on the event day or race day, you might want to get up three and a half hours before, because you want to have a bigger meal. But know it works for you, whether it's oatmeal, a bagel, banana, juice, have enough. But it's also a window leading up to the event. So a lot of people will have their big meal 3 hours before, mostly carbs. And I worked with somebody doing her first marathon earlier this week, and she was doing a lot of protein before her long run. And I switched it around. And I said, well, she likes having protein. I said, have a little bit. That's fine. You're obviously tolerating it, but you need to have more carbs before your long run. So that'll be good practice for her event. And then really it's a window. You know, do you want to have a gel 90 minutes before, or a high carbohydrate energy bar, right, 90 minutes before? And a lot of triathletes, and probably marathoners too, like to have like a gel 30 minutes before, just to top everything off. Because remember, you're getting to the event, you're eating, you have this time, you might get hungry, and then you're going to be doing this big race. So it's just good to think of fueling up until, but the window's closing in terms of what you can have. And then, you know, you get settled into your event 15 minutes in and see what you need to do. If you're swimming, obviously you're not taking anything in, but if you're running in a marathon, you might start fueling and hydrating like 20 minutes into the event.
Do you have any, for the pre-race breakfast, do you have any recommendations there for the amounts? I think I've seen it recommended, depending on, let's say you have your breakfast 3 hours before, 3 grams per kilo body weight. I think I've seen that, which to me seems like a lot to have for breakfast.
It's a lot. It's a lot. So what you can do is, what a lot of people end up doing, and what I have them end up doing, is the 3 grams per kilogram, you get that number, and then maybe you'll have 2/3 of that 3 hours before, and then you'll finish up leading up to the race getting the rest of that.
Yeah. How important is that? Because a lot of the glycogen storage obviously takes place over a period of 24 to 48 hours. So if you are somebody who don't really do so well with eating a lot of people, I think, eat quite small amounts of breakfast even before something like an Ironman, because they're nervous. Yeah, they're nervous. They don't feel like they can tolerate that. Without having any particular knowledge as you do as a registered dietitian, but as a coach, I've never really seen that as a big issue, as long as they do a good job the days before with the carb loading. But is that something that you still try to get up to a minimum level, at least what they take in for breakfast?
Well, in the pre-race meal, what you're really doing is loading up your liver glycogen stores. So your liver glycogen stores deplete overnight, you know, as you're sleeping. They might not be 100% depleted, but you've obviously filled them up because you've carbo loaded. You're not just filled up your muscles, you filled up your liver. But you know, your liver breaks down glycogen and maintains blood glucose levels while you're sleeping. And you really want to make sure that your liver glycogen stores are optimal. And then you also have some food, some carbohydrate in your small intestine, which will help you in the early part of the race before you start that fueling and hydration for the race. So, and it might top off just a little bit of muscle glycogen, but it's really about your liver glycogen and what's in the interstitial fluid around the small intestine that is providing, maintaining blood glucose levels. Remember, blood glucose is your brain's fuel supply. So you're going to deplete that quickly once you start your event. So if you can optimize the liver to maintain that, that's helpful. And it's all happening at the same time, you know, during the race. Liver glycogen is breaking down, muscle glycogen is breaking down, you're maintaining blood glucose, you're replenishing. Some of that's used for brain fuel, some of that's used for muscle fuel. It's all happening at the same time.
And when I talked with Tim Podlogar, who has done quite a bit of research, he said that he focuses on getting in fructose with breakfast because there's emerging evidence that really helps with restoring the liver glycogen. Is that something that you also focus on?
Yeah. And it's really, I think fructose was always part of the pre-race meals because you know, a lot of people like to have a banana or like an orange juice or an apple juice. And it's just an easy way to get the carbs in. You know, they're more concentrated in carbs. You don't have to eat a lot of food to get those carbs. So I think it was more about just focusing on what that really did. But we know fructose is stored in the liver. And it's just an easy way to raise liver glycogen stores. So just a mix is good. But I wouldn't say have all fructose, you know, before.
No.
It's about having the right balance. And if you look at most pre-event meals, they always had some fructose in them.
Yeah.
It was good that the science just kind of clarified that for us. That's a good thing.
Sure.
We like that. Yeah.
I think he made a point, though, that not all fruit juices are created equal in terms of you hear that it's a fruit juice or fruit. Yeah, bananas, they do have a good amount of fructose. I can't speak for orange juice and apple juice, but basically he made a point that you have to check what the actual fructose content is, because some things that you might imagine have a high fructose content have a pretty low fructose content.
Well, it has to be real fruit juice, right? Not high fructose corn syrup, right? So
yeah, I don't think we have that here. But,
thank God. Yeah. Was he talking about Europe? Was he talking about
America? I'm pretty sure because he's European based. Yeah.
Some fruits are higher in fructose than others, and I have a list that I don't have right at my fingertips to tell you what fruits are higher in fructose. Orange juice is a pretty decent source of fructose. Apple juice is probably a little bit lower. Cherry juice would be higher in fructose, I believe. But again, I don't have that list right at my fingertips.
Yeah.
But they're going to have some. But I guess what people might misunderstand is that they, you know, fruits are a source of fructose, but they're not only fructose. Like not all of the carbohydrate from fruits and fruit juices is from fructose. It could be from glucose and a mix. But it's what is the main source is probably fructose for some of them, but some of them are a little bit lower. Like berries are a little bit lower. So really, I think the fact that you're just going to have some fruit and you're going to have some juice is going to contribute to the fructose. Did he say in his research like 2 grams of glucose to 1 gram of fructose? Like, did he clarify that?
Yeah, I'm sure he did. It's been a couple of years, so I can't remember off the top of my head, but I'll link to that episode in the show notes. But yeah, I think the point was that to basically reach the amounts that were used in the research protocol that showed a positive performance effect of that increased liver glycogen, you needed a certain amount of fructose. And for that, you needed to be a bit conscious of what your sources of fructose were. I guess that was the main point.
Yeah. And that you're not going to find really on a label necessarily, but you might. But it's really more about knowing what fruits are high in fructose and what juices you want to get. But it's also going to be about what's available and what that person likes. So it's really, but that's kind of fun to know. Like, was it 30 grams of fructose out of the 180 grams that you need of carbohydrate, you know, 45 grams?
I'll link to that in the show notes and the listeners can go.
We'll find out.
Yeah.
But knowing what fruits are higher in fructose, it's like a list that like dietitians have to find so that you know a little bit more about that. So you can't look on a label and say, oh, this orange juice has 30 grams of carbohydrate per 8 ounces or 240 mls or 250 mls, depending on where you are. And it's all fructose. No, it's not all fructose, right?
Yeah, exactly. Let's move on to some nutritional deficiencies. Is that, which ones would you say are the ones that come up most commonly in your practice? And do you recommend regular testing for certain deficiencies? Can you talk a bit more about this in general?
Yeah. Well, I think it's really important for everybody to have good vitamin D levels. And I do cover that in my book. And I talk about the different levels of vitamin D, and I've got it in the American units and the European units. And I think most people now are getting their vitamin D here in the U.S. tested pretty regularly, but not everyone. And sometimes our labs say a level that's at the very low of normal is adequate, but we know now that there's higher amounts that are more optimal, and it affects health in many ways, but it can also affect performance, athletic performance. So I always check how much vitamin D somebody's on, because for many of us in North America, we have to take vitamin D almost year round. And even as far south as Atlanta, you know, which is one of our southern cities, you're not going to make vitamin D for the November to May from the sun. So you have to know how much you need. And some people need more than others to reach those optimal levels. There's different rates of absorption. And then so I definitely want them to get tested if they haven't been tested for that. And it's possible that some people are still low normal and haven't optimized that. So that would be a good thing too. And then of course, just iron stores. For me, it would be serum ferritin and what we call a complete blood count, hemoglobin, hematocrit, serum iron, but especially a serum ferritin, because serum ferritin is the storage form of iron, and it's what the body uses as a supply to make optimal levels of hemoglobin and hematocrit. So you can have low ferritin levels and it can actually affect your performance, especially at higher intensities. So it's good to optimize ferritin levels just for good health, but also just for athletes. And again, levels that might be like low normal might not be optimal for an athlete. You want it to be mid to high range for an athlete. And I think the units we use here might be different than units in Europe. So I won't go into that.
I've seen multiple units for that, and they always confuse me.
Yeah, but it's easy. I know. I understand. And vitamin D as well. So I see that, and that's easy testing. And then I can do a micronutrient test that looks at storage of different nutrients in the white blood cells of the person. And we have different micronutrient tests that dietitians can order. Doctors can order them too, but they're not like the standard ones. They're at special labs that specialize and do these things. And it could be anything. But you should do testing before making an assumption, right? But
so what micronutrients are we talking about here?
It could be all the B vitamins. It could be antioxidants. It could be calcium, vitamin D, vitamin K2, zinc, selenium, copper. Could be a lot of things. And standard blood tests for those are not very accurate. You can do B12 and folate here for standard blood tests, and they're decent tests. You can do red blood cell magnesium. It's not bad, but you can't just measure the level of a nutrient in somebody's blood and say, oh, you're deficient, you're insufficient, you're adequate. If I had to just go blindly and not do testing, as endurance athletes, what I've seen with testing is many of them are low in B vitamins in the special tests that I do. And that if they're training a lot, even if they're eating well, they're just all the training they do. B vitamins are used for energy, processing of energy, and in the Krebs cycle. So giving somebody a B complex, and this is not medical advice to anybody, but like just a basic B complex vitamin might be something that would be helpful for people for iron, like that are doing like an Ironman or marathon.
When you start working with a new athlete and they haven't done any testing at all recently, would the testing that you prescribe, would that depend on if they describe having some kind of symptoms, or is there a standard like a basic battery of tests or nutrients that you would like to test for almost regardless of what they're saying?
Some of the basic tests, I can refer them to their doctor because then it will be covered by insurance. And then I might do some testing based on, well, it's on my website, so they might choose to do that testing. They might be interested in it. So it's a matter of, do they want to spend that money? And a lot of Ironman people do, because everything's expensive when you do an Ironman. So you just kind of dive right into it. But it might, you know, I can't just say, oh, you're tired, you need B vitamins. You know, it could be they're not eating well. It could be a lot of things. But if I know they're eating in their health plan and have some blood work, I can recommend some supplementation that would be okay. But I wouldn't do that with iron either, because some people can overdose on iron, you know, if they have hemochromatosis. So it's really good to get testing done if you're going to take iron. You know, you might, but they might just be in a multivitamin with a small amount of iron in it.
Yeah. And for athletes that they're not working with a dietitian, but they have their regular like family doctor's appointment or something, and they might have the opportunity to get some testing done through that. What is there? Would you recommend once per year some kind of standard testing through the doctor? And what would you recommend in that case?
You mean food sensitivity testing?
No, more deficiencies.
Oh, definitely vitamin D. Like everybody, I don't care if they're an athlete or not, just everybody. And then I would say a complete blood count and a serum ferritin and some other iron tests for somebody who's training, regardless of age and gender, like anybody, that can be a very helpful thing to have. And then here again, you can do B12 and folate blood levels, but not the other B vitamins. And those aren't like expensive tests to do. They might be something that would be good to know as well. Yep. Yeah, and there's sometimes there people are on medication that depletes those vitamins. It's good to just see what the levels of those vitamins might be. So that would be pretty easy to have your doctor do. And then, you know, we just do standard blood work of electrolytes at checkups here, and that's fine. But it doesn't give you like athlete data, but it's just, it's fine to do that.
Let's move on to supplements beyond just the deficiencies that we've been talking about, supplements and ergogenic aids. So what's your take there? Are there any supplements that are worth taking if you don't have a tested deficiency?
Yeah, it's supplement. You mean ergogenic aids?
I hear a combination of that, because I think that you can, you have the ergogenic aids, like you have caffeine, but you also have other supplements that are being marketed, well, you know, powdered greens and things like that. So,
yeah, powdered greens, but you can eat greens, but
exactly, powder,
yeah,
yeah. When I'm asking about supplements, I'm asking about any supplement here, not just, but including ergogenic aids, but for athletes that don't have a deficiency. So, even what are the other popular ones that you have around? You know, magnesium, all sorts of things that you can find as an endurance athlete that people tell you to buy.
Yeah. A lot of people don't get enough magnesium and calcium in their diets. I think it's pretty well documented here that the magnesium levels in foods are not as high as they used to be in North America. So, and we just want everybody to get enough calcium as well. So magnesium, calcium supplement, or both, you know, separately, the right forms, the right amount, based on what do you get in your diet. Again, that's something that like your dietitian, nutritionist would know. And so you don't want to oversupplement, but you probably won't. But some forms of magnesium are much better absorbed than others. Like magnesium oxide is not a well-absorbed form of magnesium, but magnesium glycinate or magnesium bisglycinate. And that is an important mineral. It's involved in 600 enzyme systems. So there's a lot of important functions for magnesium. And having enough magnesium also helps you convert vitamin D to the active level, the active form of vitamin D. And then obviously calcium is important for muscle contraction and relaxation as well, but also for your bone health. So those might be supplements that I will definitely look at, especially with the vitamin D. And then vitamin K2, the MK7 form, helps with calcium getting into the bone and where it needs to go. it triggers something called osteocalcin, which is good for proper calcium absorption into the bone. So that might be something I would look at. And you can actually, but you have to know the levels and you have to know that health history of that person too, as well. Okay. So I might work with athletes that are middle age and perimenopausal, or I might work with athletes that are amenorrheic and young and have some disordered eating and need to think about their bone mass. So all of those things go into consideration. And I, you know, we want the men to get enough calcium and magnesium as well, and vitamin K2. Vitamin K2 may also play a role in preventing heart calcification of the coronary arteries. So again, you have to know how much to supplement. You have to know their health history. So I'm not telling everybody on this podcast to go take it. So, you know, it's good to get individual advice based on your health history. And then ergogenic aids, I think caffeine's a no-brainer, right? As far as like...
I think so.
I mean, a lot of us have it in our daily training diet. Just wake up in the morning. I had a lot of good tea this morning. Maybe you had some this afternoon to get ready for your podcast.
Absolutely.
It helps stimulate the central nervous system, our brain and our nervous system. It might play a role in the muscle, but the main role is really in the central nervous system. So during a long race, it just wakes you up. And, you know, if you get up at 3 or 4 in the morning for an event, you need a little caffeine by 11 a.m., don't you? No matter what you're doing, whether you're on your bike or going for a run. So during an event, it's good. The research has shown you could have it before, and moderate amounts work just as well as high amounts. Some people metabolize caffeine more slowly. Some people metabolize it more quickly. So you kind of have to know, you kind of know who you are, you know, from your daily life and caffeine use. Like the people that metabolize it slowly know maybe that they shouldn't have caffeine after 12 noon if they want to sleep well that night, you know, and they just have caffeine in the morning. And then we know that person who can have caffeine at 5 o'clock with dinner or before bedtime, and they just hit the pillow and fall asleep right away. It doesn't keep them up at all. Right.
Yeah.
So, but during an event, you know, a lot of gels contain caffeine. So that's probably the easiest way to get caffeine. And the research has shown that small amounts can work just as well as larger amounts in most people. But I think you have to test it in training. So let's say you're taking gels, like a gel with your sports drink on the bike. You might say, oh, halfway through the bike, I want some caffeine. Towards the end of the bike, I'll have some caffeine. A lot of triathletes, especially Ironman people, really value it on the run because that's when things are starting to get a little tiring, a little harder. And again, just knowing what your tolerances are. But caffeine does not cause dehydration. Some people still have heard that. I certainly heard that as a nutrition student early on in my career. I heard that. But then, you know, the researchers verified that it does not do that, which is a good thing. So just know your tolerances and know what you need and what works for you and what gives you that pick-me-up that you might need towards the end of your event or in the middle of your event.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm an example here that I have a bit of a contention with the research on caffeine in that we've talked about this before, actually, but all of the performance tests that are done in the research is basically between 15 minutes to 1 hour in duration. So it can be a 5K run or a 40K time trial, but they don't go longer than that. So then it makes sense that you take the caffeine up to 1 hour before, all in one dose, maybe 3 milligrams per kilo body weight, and you get the same effect as 6 milligrams per kilo body weight. But when you're doing my personal anecdote is though that in a long event like in an Ironman, when you're out there for 9 hours, that if I only take 3 milligrams per kilo over the course of the entire event, then that's a completely different situation than that situation of a 30-minute max effort. So I find that I've even gone beyond that 6 milligrams per kilo, but spread out over 9 or 10 hours, starting 1 hour before the event. And I think that that's actually worked really well. But again, I am a fast metabolizer of caffeine. So it's not something that I would recommend as generic advice, and you definitely have to practice it. But for me, I think it has quite clearly been effective to go quite high on caffeine. And I know others that have experienced the same thing as well in longer events.
Right. And the point is that you know your daily caffeine kind of chemistry and how it works for you. But you also tried that. You also practiced that in training and knew that you would be okay, that it wouldn't make you too wound up or too hyper or too like jittery, you know, which can happen to some people.
It can happen. Yeah, I really overdid it before one of my early day marathons. The first time I tried caffeine before a race, I was young and not knowledgeable, and I took way too much and got really jittery.
Did
but
you?
It wore off. Yeah, it wore off just before the start of the race, fortunately. So
yeah,
it was all good. But
and then
but,
you calm down. You calm down.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't have a big calm down. So in the end, it didn't have. I don't think it had a negative effect, but I can definitely tell that I overdid it that time. So I wouldn't recommend that either. It wasn't the most comfortable experience.
Right. Well, we all learn from races and they're all different, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
They're all a little different. That's why it's good to have sort of your structured plan and like say, okay, I've been training in cooler weather and all of a sudden this is just a crazy hot day. And what is my sweat rate in a hotter day? How do I adjust my race nutrition plan? Because all of a sudden it got hot. And that happens a lot in many areas of the United States where you can train in cooler weather and a week before the race, you know, it just, the hot weather kicks in.
Boston Marathon is always like that, isn't it?
It can be. We had a new Ironman here, Ironman Rockford 70.3. So Rockford is a small city about 90 miles northwest of Chicago. And it was early June, might have even been mid-June. And sometimes it doesn't get really hot here until mid-June. So it was much cooler weather. It was getting a little warmer. Summer was getting started. But then I'll give you the Fahrenheit. It was 98 degrees Fahrenheit that day. So is that like 32 Celsius?
No, it's way more.
It's way 35.
It's high 30s or at least above 35. Yeah. It's inching close to 40, I would say.
Yeah. So and it just flipped. It just flipped. It was a good race though. I think people enjoyed it and it was a good day. But you know, you have to adjust to that.
Yeah. Any other ergogenic aids than caffeine that are worth talking about?
You know, the flavonoids might help with recovery. You know, cherry juice and different flavonoids might help with muscle soreness and recovery. And then the beetroot juice, the nitrates might also help for, it doesn't seem to help in the top elite athletes, but sort of the mid-range athletes seem to derive a benefit from it. I'm just looking
It's falling out of favor a little bit, I think, beetroot juice or nitrate. So you don't see it as much.
Maybe you don't see it as much. You know, if somebody is doing some weight training, resistance training, I could recommend creatine, you know, during that phase. It might peter down, but I can recommend, and they can take a maintenance dose if they want to, because it's still a fuel source, right? It might not be the most common fuel source or the predominant fuel source. But if somebody's vegan or vegetarian, I might just have them take creatine as like a supplement to supplement that. Bicarbonate is kind of an old one, but it's more for short-term kind of events. The polyphenols, again, for recovery. Omega-3 fatty acids, you know, DHA and EPA, again, for recovery and inflammation might also work. But during the event, it's going to be endurance, it's going to be caffeine.
Would you consider taking bicarb before very intense sessions, like some high-intense interval session, to perhaps perform better in that session and get a better training effect?
I haven't really ever done that. I suppose somebody could. I've seen it more in track cycling, like for events that people have wanted to do bicarb and just to know that you tolerate it, which most people do. It's just baking soda and knowing the amounts, taking the right amounts, you know. And so I haven't really recommended that, but it's a consideration, right?
Yeah, I also have no experience with that, but I was curious.
Yeah.
You mentioned vegans, vegetarians. Can we go a little bit more into that? What are the special considerations that, I realize that it's different for vegans and vegetarians, so maybe it's not right to lump them together. Let's just go vegans, perhaps.
Well, my job as a dietitian is just to really give them, you know, a meal plan with their food preferences for that has enough protein. You know, the protein in a vegetarian or especially a vegan diet is not as concentrated, so they have to know the amounts. And they might, for people that are, you know, I had one vegan client doing Ironman last season, and he used some protein, you know, vegan protein supplements and just different products within, but he had plenty of foods. It's just that he needed so many calories and he had to make sure that he got everything he needed. And in fact, he even went a little high in protein because he was trying so hard to get his protein. So it's definitely doable, but you have to, you need a clear plan of how to do it. But most of the vegans that I've worked with, they know every gram of protein and everything that they consume on a regular basis because they've made sure, and it's really important to them. And then, you know, with vegetarians, you just have to see what their guidelines are. You know, how much dairy do they have? Do they have fish occasionally? Some of them do. So that's a pescatarian. But, you know, just showing them again how to balance their menu and meet all their energy needs, their protein needs, their carb needs. They usually do well with the carbohydrate, right? And they do well with the healthy fats because they're trying to get nuts and seeds, which also provides some protein. And just knowing that protein adds up from different foods, but you have to have enough of the high quality protein too.
Are there any micronutrients to consider, or is it only protein?
Zinc and iron would be two important considerations.
Yep.
Just minerals. And they can get tested for the iron, of course, like anybody would. Zinc, maybe not, but you'd have to know how to safely supplement with zinc and what amounts and what to take it with or not take it with, that kind of thing.
Hmm.
I don't want to give generic advice on that, to be honest with you.
Fair.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask about generic advice for protein, though, and not just for vegans and vegetarians, but do you have an amount, the typical Ironman athlete, are you shooting for a certain gram per kilo body weight?
You're really going to max out at 1 gram per pound or 2 grams per kilogram, 1.98 grams per kilogram. You're really going to max out. Like beyond that, you would go higher than that, maybe 2.2, 2.4 grams per kilogram of protein if you were heavily resistance training and trying to get leaner.
Hmm.
But that would be the only situation. If you're just a new endurance athlete, you're weight training somewhat, you want to build muscle, you want to get stronger, honestly, you probably just need 1.6 to 1.8 grams per kilogram. But most of us are going to eat a little more than that. It's not hard to get that unless you're just a picky eater or there's a lot of protein foods you don't like. So every once in a while, I meet someone like that, but not very often. But if you look at the research, you probably wouldn't need more than 1.8 grams per kilo, but there's no harm in getting 2 grams per kilo.
Hmm.
And, you know, and some of that's going to be from the starches you eat, the vegetables you eat, you know, just small sources of protein that add up to your total protein intake, just because you're eating a lot of food.
Yeah. I have one more question, then we had the listener questions, but actually the first listener question also blends into the last question, which is on weight loss and body composition. It's a common goal for a lot of athletes, and for some athletes, it's the reason that they start the sport in the first place. So can you talk about weight loss and body composition in your own words, and what are your advice, your thoughts and your advice around that?
Well, the way I approach is going to really depending on the time of season and how far out the degree of weight loss and body composition change they want and how far away they are from their A-list race. So what I'm trying to avoid is having them cut back too much on their energy needs when they need to get in good training blocks, right? So I've always been, even just for the everyday Joe that's exercising, I'm not a big fan of huge calorie cutting. I think it's hard to follow. I think it affects your metabolism. I think it's not a fun way to live. So I usually do more gentle calorie cutting, especially if they're closer to the race and it might not be on every training day. And usually I still want them to have good fueling around their training and have the calorie deficits occur away from training. That I find that is better for recovery and for their training. If you're going to test body composition, use a good form of it. And remember, they all have a degree of error. Even DEXA has a degree of error. You know, a lot of people use these handheld bilateral impedances in the gym. And I mean, the error can be like 5%. And for one of those, you have to be well hydrated, have an empty bladder. A lot of people get on their scale every morning and check their body composition, you know, so just keep it in perspective when you're testing body composition. And then if you do get a good test for body composition, have somebody calculate a good healthy weight goal, getting to a body composition that is realistic, but is going to help you in your performance, that you're going to like and appreciate, and also giving yourself time to get there. And that, yeah. You know, if it's like the first time you're doing it, and that's one of the reasons you're doing it, you know, maybe you don't have to reach your final goal for that race. You're going to do it again next season. Like, look at the big picture and keep the big picture in mind.
Yeah. So two common things that you tend to hear around weight loss is that for athletes, for endurance athletes, is to maybe A, make sure that you do some resistance training while you're trying to lose weight, and B, maybe increase the protein content, at least in terms of the proportions of protein that you're getting in your diet slightly. Would you agree with those?
Yeah, especially if it's early in the season or it's like post-race and you're getting ready for the next season, just the time of year. You know, depends where you live, but for many of us, it's going to be, you know, like early winter, late fall, early winter, where you're going to focus more on body composition. So yes, that's possible.
And the listener question that I had here from Gal was when and how to manage weight loss with training goals. So I think you already answered it, but basically before you get into your big training blocks for your A races, that's basically it. Or are there any other considerations with regard to timing?
If you're going to do a little bit of restricting just because you really want to get to a certain weight for the race, just weigh out the risk versus the benefits. And some days you might be able to cut back 500 calories. Some days you might cut back 300 calories, but 1,000 calories would be too much, I think, for almost anybody. And that's, you know, that's what you need to do every day for 2 pounds a week. But also remember that with all this great training that you're getting in and all this work that you're doing, you're going to get leaner that way too. It's not just cutting back on calories. It's also the training, right? They go together. So remember, there's a benefit with that too.
Yeah. And I think especially for people that are new to either cycling or swimming, they tend to put on a bit more muscle mass when they first start doing triathlon. And then you also end up burning a bit more. And sometimes you might not lose weight per se, but just your body composition improves.
And that's why it's good to find a good method of body composition testing that you can use repeatedly, but you don't need to do it every day, like on that scale in your house. That's not really going to give you real data.
Yeah. The next listener question is from Michael, not from me. Another Michael who asks, how does one balance nutrition for health versus for performance? Are they the same?
I think they can very easily be the same. I think you can have a good daily training diet. And if you're consuming 3,000-4,000 calories a day, if some of those calories come from more processed food or like desserts, that's okay, like in the context of an overall healthy diet. And I think we all know that we just have to consume more processed sugars during exercise because that's what our stomach can handle. So, and you need things that are quick and easy. So I think you just try to find a balance, but I think they're the same. You have your daily training diet, which can be, you know, 90% good quality foods. And then you have in some treats. And I mean, if you can't have treats when you're training for an Ironman, when can you have treats, right? A good gelato. Well,
that's a very, very positive answer. I like that. Good to hear.
Yeah.
And the next one is Daniel asks, what is the best time of day to consume antioxidants and how much should we consume? So maybe you can elaborate on antioxidants in general.
Do you think Daniel means from supplements?
I do not know. Questions are generally short.
Antioxidants from food, anytime, high quality foods, that's fine. I don't know that the research has really shown that taking antioxidants around exercise offers any kind of benefit. I think the research doesn't show that, but I think if he's referring to like vitamin C, vitamin E, usually we take fat soluble vitamins with a meal that contains fat. Vitamin C is probably, you could take that anytime, but there was one study that showed that if Ironman triathletes took too much vitamin E, that actually hurt their performance. And it actually increased inflammation. It was like a pro-oxidant rather than an antioxidant. So I think there's a lot of nuances to that. So without knowing the more specifics of what he was questioning about, and again, I wouldn't want to give generic advice on that anyway, but I don't know of any like studies that showed you have to do it this time or this time.
Yeah.
And it might really depend on the nutrient as well.
And I think, unless I missed it, but this is not something that you mentioned as something that you commonly would recommend supplementing with. Am I wrong in that?
I don't commonly recommend antioxidant supplements. Yeah. No.
And then the final question, I think we actually...
I'll correct that. Like if I did the micronutrient testing, some of those are testing our antioxidants. I'll see which ones appear to be insufficient. So it's not always a deficiency. It could be insufficient. I would target that for a period of time based specifically on the testing that person did.
Right.
Yeah.
The final question here that we'll do from the listeners is from Renee, who is asking... I think we covered it mostly, but let's just repeat it. How important are electrolytes or sodium replacement during a 7-on-3 or Ironman for an age grouper?
I think they're pretty important. I don't think it will hurt you to have adequate electrolytes, especially sodium, during an Ironman. It's really sodium that we focus on, sodium chloride or salt. And sodium also plays a role in helping glucose get across the small intestine and into the bloodstream for fueling. And again, just maintaining healthy, safe blood sodium levels. So I think for an Ironman, so you hear, oh, it's only really for extreme conditions, but I could make the case that any Ironman is an extreme condition. You know, like we all know each other and we do the training, but if it's going to be a half Ironman, it could be a long day for a lot of people. If it's a full Ironman, you know, even the fastest people, it's a good solid race, right? Race day. It's a full day. So I think that it's important to just maintain that because safely and moderately and sensibly, unless you know you're an outlier that has really high sodium losses for whatever reason, or you've had trouble in training with it and you need to figure that out. But
yeah.
I think I haven't heard of anybody overdoing sodium in a really long time. I think when the salt tablets first came out, I worked with somebody who told me, oh, I felt bad during my Ironman. I stopped and I took 10 salt tablets. And then, of course, you know, her stomach was wretched and she had to, you know, lose all that. And I haven't heard of anybody doing anything that silly in years.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, that's a good answer. Actually, one question that I didn't ask earlier when we were discussing that race nutrition is, what is the, basically in terms of athletes preparing their bottles, their fuel, and how much
carbohydrates
to take in, how much sodium to take in, how, because there is clearly a some kind of relationship there between the osmolality and how well you absorb, how you absorb things. So can you talk generally around this and
generally sports drinks are 6-8% concentration, but a lot of Ironman people, depending on their fueling needs, their sweat rate, and what they can drink during, might go up to an 8-10% concentration, but they have to practice that in training, and that's something that I help people figure out. You know, a lot of the drinks they use are powdered, so that I can adjust it and make adjustments. And then how many bottles can you carry on the bike? How much sodium is in the bottle? Do you want to add a sodium supplement to, you know, like an electrolyte supplement to the drink a little bit, just to get it at a level that you feel more comfortable with, that you've tested with your sweat patch or your NICs. And then it's just, that's one of the things that I do. That's a big, huge part of what I'm doing. But I think for a full Ironman, a lot of people like to have something a little solid occasionally on the bike too. You just get hungry, right? It's just like a little mini snack. They might have half of an energy bar, or they might have a jam sandwich, something, but you have to be really careful and practice it in training and know that you can tolerate it and take it with enough water. And that's true with gels too. You have to make sure you take them with enough electrolyte water And some gels have more electrolytes than others. So that's everything. It all goes back to all that pre-planning and practicing and figuring out what you need and how you're going to balance it all. And then I'm a fan of trying to carry bottles on the bike and pre-preparing them and not saying, oh, the weight of this is going to slow me down on the bike versus I have everything I need for fueling, but also knowing what you're going to have to use from the course, you know, from the aid stations on the course, what you're going to have ready in your special needs bag for a full Ironman that you have ready and pre-made as well, and know exactly what you're going to do every hour. That's how I lay it out.
Yeah, no, that's a good answer. And can you just quickly explain for people that maybe are not familiar, when you talk about 6% concentration or 10% concentration, what does that mean?
It's something that we call osmolality, and it's basically the solute load, how many little particles are in the fluid, and how it affects this emptying from your stomach. So a 6 to 8% concentration is going to empty just as easily as water and then be absorbed in the small intestine. But you can also train your stomach to handle an 8 to 9, maybe a 10% concentration, but some people will struggle with 10%. And then if you take a gel, that's really like a 20% concentration, I believe. And that's why it's so important to take the gel or any solid food with plenty of water so that you're basically helping it empty from your stomach. So just think of when you have like a really big meal versus a small meal, how full you feel afterwards and how that can change for you.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you, Monique. This has been brilliant. And I learned a lot of things, and I hope the listeners did too. Let's take a moment to talk about your book and where they can find it and what they can expect if they get it.
Well, you'll get a great reference book that's 500 pages that where you can access different topics and read on those topics as you need to learn more about them. So if you're planning to carbo load, you can go to the carbo load section. If you're planning to learn more about sweat rate and checking your sweat rate, you can go to that section. But it is 500 pages, so there's a lot of good information in here. Section 1 has just good nutrition. Section 2 is all the training nutrition, body composition changes, ergogenic aids, and section 3 is the sport specific guidelines for nutrition. And then section 4 is special nutrition considerations, like are you at altitude, extreme environments. And then there's an appendix that has the glycemic index of foods, information on vitamins and minerals, sports nutrition product comparisons, and then creating the optimal training diet and some sample menus. And then there's a worksheet for sweat losses. Now, you can buy it a lot of ways. Amazon is probably the most well-known purveyor. I know we've got Amazon North America. I know it's on Amazon Australia. I believe it must be available that way in Europe as well.
I'm sure. Yeah, I haven't checked, but probably.
Yeah.
It's Sports Nutrition for Endurance Athletes. I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah. It was published by Surrey Books, Agate Surrey. And, you know, they have wide distribution. So it shouldn't be a hard book to find. My website is MoniqueRyan.com, and I have the book on the Endurance Sports Nutrition page with links to lots of places where you can purchase it besides Amazon.
Brilliant. Well, yeah. Thank you again. It was great to chat to you, and have a fantastic Friday.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with links that were mentioned. I'll link, of course, to Sports Nutrition for Endurance Athletes, which is Monique's book, which I have. It's a really good, comprehensive book. So if you're interested in having all information in one place, then that's a great resource for that. We referenced the episode that I did with Tim Podlogar. That was episode 354, Carbohydrates, Science and Practice. It's a really good episode. I highly recommend you listen to it if you're interested in digging a bit deeper. Lots of great stuff. And Tim is one of the foremost experts in the world on this. He's a scientist, but he's also working in practice with World Tour cycling teams and so on. So yeah, he's a great guest. So a great follow-up episode to listen to after this. I also have listed some other somewhat related episodes, or quite related episodes, I should say, on the topics of nutrition and fueling and so on. And I won't list them all right now, but just one that I want to highlight is episode 366, The Performance Chef, Alan Murchison. This is probably my personal favorite episode that I've ever done on the topic of nutrition for several reasons. The content-wise, it's really great, but Alan is also just as a person, as a speaker, he's really engaging. He's somebody that you could have a conversation with for hours and you would absolutely not get bored. So I really recommend that. As I said, I think it's my personal favorite episode that I've done on nutrition. So check it out. It was a while ago, so for hopefully many of you that are listening now weren't listeners back then even, so we might have missed that. Go back and listen to it. I highly recommend it. And if you need any help with your training, whether you have big ambitious goals like placing at a world championship event or whether you want to complete your first triathlon without getting injured, at scientifictriathlon.com, we have a bunch of products and services that can help you on the way. We provide high-quality coaching, training plans, and other related services, consultations, etc., to help athletes of all levels achieve their goals. And this time of year is the perfect time to start up with getting some professional help and support if you have goals for next year, because the more time you have before a big goal, the bigger the difference you can make to your performance level and your likelihood of achieving that goal. So we've already helped hundreds of athletes through individual coaching and thousands of athletes through training plans, and we'd love to help you as well. So to learn more about this, to learn more about our coaching, our training plans, and everything else we're doing, just go to scientifictriathlon.com or email me directly on michael@scientifictriathlon.com, and that's Michael with a K. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS2025. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.